Good morning, everyone. Because we see two bodies does not mean that we don't have a full auditorium today. Many are here in mind, if not in form. Due to circumstances beyond our control. Nevertheless, we're here to spread broadcast the teachings of Theosophy as recorded in the writings of H.P. Blavatsky and William P. Judge via this small little pamphlet called the Declaration. And this declaration states plainly that the policy of this lodge is independent devotion to the cause of Theosophy without professing attachment to any Theosophical organization. It is loyal to the great founders of the Theosophical movement, but does not concern itself with dissensions or differences of individual opinion. The work it has on hand and the end it keeps in view are too absorbing and too lofty to leave it the time or inclination to take part in side issues. That work and that end is the dissemination of the fundamental principles of the philosophy of Theosophy and the exemplification and practice of those principles through a true realization of the self, a profound conviction of universal brotherhood. It holds that the unassailable basis for union among theosophers, wherever and however situated, is similarity of aim, purpose, and teaching. Therefore, has neither constitution, bylaws, officers, nor officers, the sole bond between its associations or associates, being that basis. And it aims to disseminate this idea among theosophers in the furtherance of unity. It regards as theosophers all who are engaged in the true service of humanity, without distinction of race, creed, sex, condition, or organization, and it welcomes to its association all those who are in accord with its declared purposes and who desire to fit themselves by study and otherwise to be the better able to help and teach others. The true theosophist belongs to no cult or sect, yet belongs to each and all. This little document, we recommend that you pick up one before you leave today. There are plenty of them in the front of the building. And as our custom, we remind you that we opened the doors this morning at 10:30 and we began at 11 and we'll be done by noon. Talk or discussion. On Wednesdays, we open the door from 5:15 to 7:15 to allow you to visit our library. It's a reference library and will speak for itself because it's for free use. Today is April 7th. The talk today will be on Zoroaster, his
name. No, it's May 5th. May 5th.
Excuse us, we're behind the time. May 5th, and it's Psychism and Spirituality, Lower and Higher Psychic Faculties. Now, we will remind you that on May 8th is White Lotus Day in memorial of H.P. Blavatsky and also Theosophy. And you also see on here the date June 23rd is ULT Day, its mission and its future. Having read this, we still recommend that you pick up one and read it yourself and learn what it's all about. Now, as is our custom, we have a reading before we begin. And this is a reading from The Voice of the Silence. fragment one. These instructions are for those ignorant of the dangers of the lower Iti. He who would hear the voice of Nada, the soundless sound, and comprehend it, he has to learn the nature of Dharana. Having become indifferent to objects of perception, the pupil must seek out the Raja of the senses, the thought producer, he who awaits illusion. The mind is the great slayer of the real. Let the disciple slay the slayer. For when to himself his form appears unreal, as do on awaking all the forms he sees in dreams. When he has ceased to hear the many, he may discern the one, the inner sound which kills the outer. Then only not till then shall he forsake the region of asat, the false, to come into the realm of sat, the true. Before the soul can see, the harmony within must be attained, lest the eyes be rendered blind to all illusion. Before the soul can hear the image, man has to become as deaf to roarings as to whispers, to cries of bellowing elephants as to the silvery buzzing of the golden firefly. Before the soul can comprehend and may remember, she must unto the silent speaker be united. Just as the form to which the clay is modeled is first united in the potter's mind. But then the soul will hear and will remember, and then to the inner ear will speak the voice of the silent.
Thank you. This morning's title, Higher and Lower Psychic Faculties, is one that always intrigues the general public, certainly. So let's start with a common understanding of terms and maybe a brief refreshing about what the general public would think before we turn our minds to theosophical universals and the applications of those. The word psychic is from the Greek psuche, psyche, and it pertains to every phase and manifestation of powers and potencies of human and divine souls. For the general public, probably what comes to mind when they hear psychic faculties is mental phenomenon of mediumship of all different kinds. They might think about higher sensitivities other than the physical senses. They might think about hypnotic reception or inspired prophecy, perhaps. Some kind of clairvoyance in the astral with fortune tellers or folks that can produce information out of seeming nothing. What the general public, upon hearing the word psychic, would probably not think about is that real divine seership. Those folks that are involved with very organized religion who base their belief system on revelation or divine inspiration, they're all considering psychic faculties, but they just may not know it. They may see it more as an accident, a freak of nature among some folks. They may see it as the work of the devil, but they rarely will apply it to inspired or divine seership. The word faculties, straightforward. Most of us think about school systems and teams of teachers at university. But faculties also means inherent mental or physical powers, capability, capacity, potential, potentiality. So our title, Higher and Lower Psychic Faculties, is actually very general, very universal, covering a range of expressions of potentials or talents or powers that are inherent in the nature of the human and that are then brought forth. So if we go away from the popularized notion of psychism or psychic faculties, and we turn to universal principles, if we turn to theosophical truths upon which we could lay our investigation or lay our consideration, we're reminded in the conversations on theosophy that there is a omnipresent, eternal, boundless, and immutable principle on which all speculation is impossible. It transcends the power of human conception at this plane. And again, that would be akin to most of the world religions teaching of an unknowable, that which stands behind the masks of the gods. In the writings of Blavatsky in The Secret Doctrine, she alerts us to the universality of these faculties with a caveat. This is from The Secret Doctrine, Volume 2, page 319. Civilization has ever developed the physical and the intellectual at the cost of the psychic and the spiritual. The command and the guidance over his own psychic nature, which foolish men now associate with the supernatural, were with early humanity innate and congenital, and they came to man as naturally as walking and thinking. So again, these faculties are accepted universally from the darkest recesses of human experience, far beyond written history, as universal, applicable to one and all in the human form. And nothing that is frightening or demonic or foolish, but a range of something very, very different. Judge, writing on psychic faculties in the culture of concentration, had this to say. And again, this will help us, whether we're visitors or established students, to see the realities of the theosophical teachings. Judge wrote, "Let us premise first the body now visible." That's easy for the general public to premise. Supposedly tangible, experiential. Second, premise that there is an inner man, not the spirit, something else, the astral. And third, there is the spirit itself. Further, he wrote, "Now, while it is quite true that the second or the inner man has latent all the powers and peculiarities ascribed to the astral body, it is equally true that those powers are, in the generality of persons, still latent or only very partially developed." So we have the sense of an eternal fount or source manifesting in a triumvirate, if you will, of spirit, of physicality, and of the astral or the inner. And within that triumvirate is a range of possibilities of the ability to sense from the environment, the ability to manipulate the environment, the ability to gain knowledge and wisdom in a range of experiences, and to act upon that. In terms of the highest or the higher psychic faculties, we have a variety of sources that treat the notion of the great enlightenment ones far beyond what the younger folks in our culture now call woke personalities, but fully enlightened. The Mahatmas, the great souls, the Arhats that appear among people across time in all nations. An advanced soul, a great soul or Mahatma, is one who has earned a knowledge of law and faith and who has developed the use of will and imagination. In other words, by right living and motive across a series of incarnations, such a one has gained power over matter, mind, space, and time. Boundless psychic power, the highest of spiritual faculties we could imagine, the highest we could imagine of psychic faculties, that is boundless in potentiality. And intuition is the nth degree among them. But as Judge wrote in The Ocean, that highest level, that highest order of enlightenment or clairvoyance, that of spiritual vision, is very, very rare and comes only to those who are pure, devoted, and firm. It may only be attained by special development and only after long duration of discipline, training, and the practice of the highest, purest altruism. So, that's potential in each and all. What some would call divine inspiration or revelation, what others would call the sainted or the great Mahatmas, that's the potential available to every self-conscious entity using the human forms, physical body, astral form. The problem is there's this tremendous range of potentiality. And without knowledge, without purified desire, without purified will, imagination, without disciplined concentration, without the use of the wisdom of natural law, of cause and effect, ethics and morality, if you will, without that, where are we left with the general public? Ourselves. Folks, souls in process, souls in evolution, working as best they can through the environment available to them. That's where this lower range of psychic faculties can appear. It's personal, usually focused on an emotion, a karmic kind of a desire. It's usually self-interest with self with a small s, if not selfish. And it usually deals with a degree of sentimentality that has to do with the lowest aspects of the astral. When we think about what the general public observes on TV with some of the demonstrations of psychic faculties, they may notice a passivity on the part of the medium or the practitioner. There may be a trance. There might even be something that looks like a minor petit mal seizure before they enter that trance. If it's a scenario where there's someone who is still conscious and in control of their aspects of mind, when that individual calls on somebody in the audience, they're actually picking out someone in the audience who's passive, if they're doing truly psychic phenomena. And on the other hand, we know there are plenty of tricksters around. Depending on the morality of the medium or the practitioner, depending on the nature of desires or emotions involved in the motivation, and depending on if money's changing hands, what is natural in terms of psychic potential can be twisted or perverted. It is a partial use of the full potentiality. It's a use more of a parlor trick and an interest in the phenomenon as opposed to what we see among the history of high adepts of true spiritual clairvoyance. Does that mean that all is lost? We've got this potential. We see how it can be twisted by some who are going to face incredible karmic reactions from their use of these lower aspects of the power. And we find ourselves not yet Mahatmas, certainly not even assuming that we're anywhere near the path to becoming a Mahatma. So what's available to the student who's a beginner, who's trying to understand that these are natural phenomena, this is natural potentiality, and this is something to be prepared for, that across many lives, across reincarnation periods, through the duration of making sincere efforts, all of these potentialities will awaken naturally within any soul according to law. So what are we to do? Well, if we're trying to hold our own in life and be the best we can be, to use soul to raise the physical and the mental, we find solace in the fact that there are treasures of the spirit, as once was said in this room, that in the enlightened or the godly person or the humble disciple or student who is attempting to follow the example of an enlightened one, we know that intuition exists. We can find plenty of evidence of that. That pure intuition may come and go in a lifetime. That what we may find is that we need to have a hunch, think about that in an intuitive sense, and then judge it with a discerning vision. We can work on compassion and holding strong compassion directed by will on behalf of others, the whole of humanity, every single individual in humanity, no matter whose actions are the most heinous, but one and all, and compassion directed by will toward entire manifestation, the nature of the globe, the rocks and minerals, the environment of the vegetation, the animal state, every single kingdom of manifestation. We can hold that a sacred treasure, a spiritual treasure impacted in soul, is sympathy and empathy, is altruism, is a notion of universal brotherhood. And if we set about our daily lives making every attempt to set soul and mind first, above and beyond the body, the astral, the general desires, if you will, if we truly exercise every day, not like a gym rat physically someplace in a gym, but if we exercise every day, walk with the Lord, as some of the Christians would say, what's going on? We're aligning our use of mind and body with the spiritual, with the highest potentialities we can imagine, that we can hold as an ideal. And we can make efforts to raise the self, the personal self, by the spiritual self, and therefore pursue true spiritual knowledge and let go. Live, learn, and let go. Allow life to unfold. Experience the effects of the causes that we've set up in the past. And just wait and see, literally, to watch and to learn throughout time. Now, I'm sure that you came to this morning's talk with your own thinking and your own ideas on this particular subject matter. Yes?
So we can say that the performance of these psychic powers, they can be done the same way, but there's the lower performance is done without training, without knowledge, and passivity. Whereas the same action can be done from a higher aspect, done with knowledge and being done actively and being in control. Is that right?
Yeah, and when we say actively or in control, in the notion of meditation and concentration, the philosophy offers the point of view that as long as we are conscious on this plane, we are to remain self-reliant and to look within for direction, to look within for the observation of how to use thought, word, and deed, of how and when to produce sound or not. And so the potential is there. There is this psychic potential because there is an astral inner body in which the true senses reside. And that can be tapped. And again, it depends on motive, knowledge, and the wisdom to know when and how to act. You know, there's so many things human beings do out of the kindness of their hearts. There was an example in the South Pacific following World War II where some very well-meaning Christian missionaries arrived on some islands and they noticed that there were very crude handmade knives that very, very few people in this little tribal group had access to. And the entire culture seemed to swing around who had the knife, who could use it, when could they use it. Everybody had to wait. There was this rough situation where the missionary knew that if everybody had a modern knife, they could get so much more accomplished. And it's like, you know, Blavatsky wrote so long ago that with civilization, the physical and the intellectual is at the cost of the psychic and the spiritual. What the missionary never stopped to think was, my motives are good, but am I helping this group help themselves? And so when Christmas came and the missionary handed out knives to every man, woman, and child, it was the end of the entire fabric of that society. And within two generations, they died out and were gone. Because what had happened was that there was a hierarchy of leadership based on law and earned potentiality. Those knives were created and honed across generation. That's why they were so primitive, because they were. But they worked perfectly fine. But once the younger ones and the women had full access to better equipment than the elders and the sages, it was the end of the entire fabric. Again, the motive was fine. The action was something that was accomplishable. It was fine to do financially, but there was lack of wisdom. There was lack of discerning thought and foresight. Your hand?
Yeah, there's a section in the key that talks about charity and how what you just described, the unintended consequences of goodwill, that we have to act with knowledge. But we're wondering in this situation that was just described, how they could have ever known. You know, how many of us could have made the same assumption So if we don't have the knowledge, we want to be charitable, how do we act? Where do we start?
Well, in that anecdote, the assumption probably, the flaw in the thinking probably harkened back to separatism. And on the behalf of the missionary, although well-intentioned, very, very kind, very pure-hearted, there was another insidious perception. My culture, my technology, me, are better than you, and let me save you. Let me help you. The flip side was, let me kill you with kindness, in essence, is what happened. And how many times in daily life have we walked through scenarios without being open to the fact that I am you, you are me, and we are equal spiritually? What is there I can learn from you? It's a very different stance, that universal brotherhood, that oneness of experience, and the openness to, I know I've always held this idea in this incarnation, but is it the right premise? Yeah.
It seems apparent that we struggle with this divide around the world of being able to perceive the other as equal. Part of it, the solution could be in education, but that notion of I'm better, and my way is better is very deep and very unconscious and difficult for us to access and see and act upon.
That separateness and that self-centeredness, ethnocenteredness, is primal. When you think about an infant who is pre-literate, they do see that ancient symbol of a circle with a point from birth. They see that in the shape of their caregiver's eyes. The pupil in the eye is a circle and a point. If they're being nursed or bottle fed, it doesn't matter. They still see a round nipple with a point in the middle. So they're still seeing that symbol. But across time, once their physical vision flips and they can see right side up, they begin to see a particular type of face as a caregiver or provider, a particular kind of face in the mirror. And so initially, very small children, working as small animals do, that's what's familiar and comfortable. And it's the very fortunate soul, it's the blessed soul who has the life experience of coming up in a blended family. Young, old, sick, healthy, of various races, various sizes and shapes, with caretakers one and all, so that the child's expression, you know how when someone's really happy or they're in love, their eyes, the pupil expands greatly in the center of the iris. The fortunate soul raised in an environment to be open gradually sees the entire world as their safe place to land, every single individual that they come in contact with. Yeah.
Adding to that, the notion, evolutionary notion of how we progress as individuals from egocentric to ethnocentric to world-centric. And there's a natural evolution, and you really can't skip, or some people say you have to have the training and the learning at the ego to become then the ethno. You get the view there, and only from there can you then transcend and grow wider to a world-centric.
Right. Yeah, and that growth in what is my sense of self and how do I apply it from individual to ethnic group to the world and beyond, because even those that connect with other human beings may not be thinking about animal life, vegetables, minerals. that expansion process is part of that enlightenment. And it's Maslow's hierarchy of needs that speaks to the notion that unless and until a human being's basic needs are met, each of the different levels of perception are not yet available. So as long as folks are scrambling to keep food on the table, a roof over their heads, their family intact, whatever else the necessities of life are, security perhaps in a bad environment, as long as that scramble's going on, it's the rare individual who is freed up karmically then to begin to rise in degrees of awakening. Yeah.
But isn't it just simply ideas that we cling to that are causing our conflict? That of being separate in the sense that that I'm different, or I'm actually alone, and that I'm actually doing this by myself. That we feel separate. But if we look around the world, we see that the communities or the people that thrive are the ones that cooperate.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not the ones that compete. We see the competitive nations and what's going on. And because you can only measure competition materially. But the other aspects of life, you can't. And what you're saying, this psychic nature of us, that is our part of our feeling nature. And I would assume compassion is the highest expression of that. And it's not a word, it's a word, but it's a feeling that we have for each other. I think that's how humanity is going to change. It's through knowing that, if we're ruled by our mind, we see what happens. If we're ruled by our heart, we can blossom.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's what, the Gita talks about that and how we can do that. We're all on a pilgrimage. We're just trying to sort out here in the mud, which way to go? And what's really going on? Aren't we as a nation, or we only see nations hypnotized or passively going along with the drumbeat? It's a passivity. I think it's part of our natures to be passive, to be wanting to be nurtured and taken care of. I think we can turn that on and off. And I think once when we become self-conscious of that, when we become single-minded and mm-hmm. focused.
So part of the process then is to really dedicate a portion of the day and as many moments in between waking and sleeping as we can to be introspective, to practice metacognition, to think about how we're feeling, to think about how we're thinking in response to something. So the questioning would continue the internal dialogue of, is that all there is? If I'm at rest today, and on this particular day I don't have any challenges, life is good, and I find myself in a kind of la-la state, that passivity of just sloshing along, floating through life, nothing in particular to do, maybe mentally daydreaming. Intuitively, don't we know that that's a waste of time and that that's a rest period? Most of us have learned in this life that it's in times of crisis or in times of challenge or in times when we can vicariously learn from someone else's traumas that true learning, that true expression happens. and begins to grow. And it's a peaceful kind of a thing. It may look like from the outside that, you know, from somebody looking at us, we're not doing anything. We just may be the observer, the witness on the scene. But that's the right performance of yoga, isn't it? To be in the world, to be in the turmoil, to learn from that experience, all the while inner heart, soul, mind, however you want to understand that notion, is subdued, concentrated, and peaceful. So that interplay between the higher and the lower is where the action is. We're mind beings. That's where the action is. There can be no passivity if that's the process we're doing. You have a follow-up?
No, you were just trying to grasp what psychism is and how is it created, and we're taken back to the secondary nature of man, and that the astral plane is of its own substance, is another state of consciousness, and that is state. I think it says in the ocean that jiva is very closely attached to the astral body, so which animates it and which gives it a power.
Mm-hmm.
And I just realized that our passivity is just sort of a way of life, that we're in and out of passivity, and otherwise we couldn't function in this society. We have to go along with what's understood, and that we turn ourselves over to that reptilian nature, that reptilian brain in our head, and so we can drive from here to there, and not be paying attention, but really our mind can be somewhere else.
And there's nothing more frightening than driving through the state of New Hampshire not realizing you've been there until you become aware in Massachusetts.
Well, not frightening, but you're absolutely amazed.
Yeah.
You're absolutely amazed. Something is higher, that's, but thank goodness it's higher. Could it be something lower?
It could be something way lower. Yes?
We were wondering, because the reading was from the voice.
The voice.
And the silence.
Mm-hmm.
Do we have a way of acknowledging what is the voice of the silence within?
Okay, let's go back to the reading. He who would hear the voice of nada, the soundless sound, also known as the spiritual sound, and comprehend it, has to learn the nature of dharana, intense, perfect concentration of mind upon an inner object. So, if we're indifferent to external objects, we're sitting in meditation, we're trying to forget whether the room is hot or cold, whether there's the noise of a nearby washing machine or children playing or whatever. And we're trying to focus our concentration within, not on the external senses, but on the way the mind can work through the inner body. That's one process of attempting to reach the voice of conscience. And folks do that in self-assigned fixed periods of devotional meditation. Can you do that in the middle of real life? Yeah.
Yes. But it takes practice, it takes devotion. Our mind has to be centered on not always the material, but on that aspect of ourselves.
Okay,
that is immaterial.
So what you're focused on, if you're focused on the immaterial, spiritual, I know I have a conscience within me, and ideas pop into my head without sound telling me, that's not to do, this is to do. That can happen, but if I get caught up in the eruption around me, in the material and what I think I can quantify, it's a whole different. The voice reading said, become indifferent to objects of perception. The pupil must seek out the Raja of the senses, the thought producer. So not to be concerned with the hubbub without, but rather in the midst of the hubbub, witness the scene and step back. Your hand went up and down real fast? Yeah.
Yeah, I forgot what I was
going to say. Oh, okay. We'll be back. You know, remember as a child being told, count to 10 before you speak. Or MYOB, mind your own business, hush up, back up. Those and 12-step people know the phrase, the power is in the pause. All of those things are popular ways of talking about the fact that while we have a lower mind that daydreams and races from, you know, thought to thought and fritters away, thinking about sparkly, glittery, materialistic side of life, there's also that mind raised above that and withdrawn from it that can, in a duration of time, produce a whole different avenue of thought. Yeah.
I think the Gita just says that there's something of us that is unchanging, that is eternal, that is boundless, that is immutable, and is omnipresent. Mm-hmm. That we have there's something that is that, and that is unchanging. So that we can sit and come to our own conclusions by eliminating all that changes and come to that which is unchanging. Mm-hmm. And it's always that procedure, that perception that we have, that consciousness, that I think that's what we all are pursuing, of how to make it appear more often in our life that we're conscious of that consciousness, of being the same in essence as everyone in the world, but everyone around you, and even all of nature.
The Gita is a wonderful poem, textbook. You can read it at so many different levels. And it takes us back to the judge premise from the beginning of the talk. First, there's the body that's now visible. It is. Second, there's the inner man, the astral, where the senses reside, where the soul begins to pull back from that physical and begins to think and respond to life, where the creative forces are used in a lower kind of a way. But then, above and beyond, as was just stated, there is spirit. There is the eternal self, the perceiver, that is extant, changeless, and is always, always, always there. But what happens is the personality, the body, the physical lower mind, the lower aspects of the astral need to be manipulated and fine-tuned and purified so that the entire essence of that triune eternal man can become porous to what the spirit has to say, the soundless sound. Yeah?
A related, very similar model is our three realms of experience, which is mental cognition and emotional, and maybe astral has to do with the sensory awareness, within those three realms of experience, and by meditating on them and becoming aware of them, we become aware of the underneath, the wordless, thoughtless, sensationless underneath, which is pure awareness, and that that's more truly where our essence is and where we reside.
Mm-hmm.
So that thought and feeling and emotion, both external and internal, become objects in this field of awareness.
Okay, so some of them, the objects are external, but this is all describing the environment of the soul. That all those layers of existence describe the environment of the soul and, frankly, the tools that the soul has to work with at any one time. Further on in the culture of concentration, Judge had this to say. This inner being is, so to say, inextricably entangled in the body, cell for cell and fiber for fiber. The inner being exists in the body somewhat in the way the fiber of the mango fruit exists in the mango. In that fruit, we have the inside nut with thousands of fine fibers spreading out from it through the yellow pulp all around. And as you eat it, there is a great difficulty in distinguishing the pulp from the fiber. So that the inner body of which we are speaking cannot do much when away from his physical body and is always influenced by it. It is not, therefore, easy to leave the body at will and roam about in the double, which is said to be a potential of that astral. Yeah.
It says that the use of this astral, is, you know, this other world, is called magic.
Hmm.
You know, it's the knowing of our true nature, and then therefore of the nature of nature, and that you know, that all of, like Simon Magnus, all the known magicians, or like Solomon and so forth, that just a good control of our lower nature. That psychic aspect of it, and but that's why theosophy is being again brought to the world, so that we can develop our moral and our ethical nature, and do that first before we get all these powers that we will use, you know, for the ill of mankind.
Mm-hmm.
Rather than for its benefit.
When we think about the inventiveness of the human being, my word, we've got a whole range. There's an explosion in technology since World War II. But with that comes a remarkable, horrible degree of responsibility if we don't know what we're doing. In the 1950s, children were sprayed with DDT. Now we know that DDT is so toxic that we wouldn't dare use it in our environment. We've gone on to, quote, bigger and better things, of course. But DDT is used elsewhere in the world still, but thankfully no one is any longer spraying children with it. So we have this potential to invent and experiment and to build and to create, but without the proper basis of thought, without that ethical, I better respond to my sense of duty and that intuition in the back of my head that's saying, wait a minute, is that really a good thing to do? We better be super careful that we err on the side of saying, all right, as students of theosophy, we accept, we see psychic phenomena, we can relate various degrees of, quote, magic, high and low. But before we dabble, before we allow someone that we love to dabble, or someone that we hate to dabble, better that we offer the advice, clean up your lower nature. Purify the use of thought, word, and deed, and motive. Think about universal brotherhood as a real and an ideal. Practice acting from that until it becomes reflexive, and all the rest will unfold. Yeah.
Right. Part of what you said, the ability to evaluate one's true intent. So in the DBT, probably the ultimate intent was, gee, this is just going to make so much money for us because we can really make those crops better. And at the bottom of that is there are not enough resources in the world. We have to make sure we get enough. That fear of lack, that there's not enough for everybody, which is a lower fear-based motivation.
Mm-hmm.
And so can we examine ourselves deeply enough to see what our true intent is? If it's coming from fear and self-protection for the benefit of everybody.
Is it coming from fear and self-protection? But what self is being the protective? So that the body is, we've got a karmic field of experience that we've created the correct magnetic attraction, that this is it. For this incarnation, this is the form that we have at our avail. Karmically, we've also developed from many past lives a degree of psychic sensitivity or not. There are some born with very wide-ranging sensitivity that's not metaphysical and spiritual, but it certainly is hyper-physical. It is super-sensual. And then there are others that are sitting trying to figure that out and to learn it. But just the very thought process of what degree of substance is fighting to exist. Am I hungry or is it an appetite? If I'm fearful, is it the body that's fearful? Is it the personality that's fearful of being embarrassed or in some way changed by a process of concentrated effort? Where is it coming from? And it usually is coming from the temporary, tangible life form expression that likes the manifestation and that wants to revel in that, as opposed to the faith and the calm and the peace and the security, the wisdom of that voice of the silence, nothing to fear. I am that I am. There's nothing to fear. Yes.
We just find it ironic. Here we are, a generation after a great war, where the idea of using people as guinea pigs or as a means to an end was fought against and conquered. But you can't kill ideas by killing people. And that has become prevalent because these ideas still exist, because we have the same things going on, spraying DDT on people, using experimental formulas on soil and for killing insects, and just not tested against humane practices that we are all one and that we affect everything around us. So it's not so much people that we are fighting against, it's ideas that we are fighting against.
Plato said ideas rule the world. And there's also the wisdom that he or she who doesn't know their history is condemned to repeat it. So there's lots for us to be aware of and to hone in on, all in the effort of purifying and uplifting, to walk in the path of Kuan Yin, to lift all beyond all conditioned expressions of manifestation. See you on Wednesday. Please, please, Wednesday is a commemorative meeting. Come a little bit early. It starts with kind of a meditative repose, if you will, in the room. but we'll see you then.